Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast, the complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 43, October 25th, 2010. Jim Trafficant can win in Ohio, but right now he needs immediate support to grab House seat, by R.K. Traveler. Jim Trafficant's 2010 congressional race is arguably the nation's most important election, and that is why they totally ignore it. To make sure the American people, especially the good folks in Ohio's 17th district in Youngstown, don't even know Big Jim is running. You may ask if doing the right thing is even a factor in American elections anymore. When America was still America, choosing the right thing was understood to be the reason for any decision, but big money became the master of politics. Politicians, desperate to win, paid whatever their expert advisors demanded. The lobbyists clamored to cover those costs in exchange for access. Legalized bribery. To reach the voting public, you have to pay small fortunes to the corporate media that controls what we can and cannot see. In early 2010, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling stole our individual rights to freedom of speech and gave them to corporations, reducing us to helpless zeros. Materialism and cowardice rule Congress. Thus, Congress is easy prey for the predatory agents of super-profitable imperialism that foster economic depression and no-win wars. To get and maintain power, they made examples of certain politicians, especially Trafficant. The cowardly turnstiles in Congress were so timid that all it took was a threat to give their money to an opponent's campaign, and these jellyfish dropped to their knees and apologized for dribbling saliva on their lobby master's boots. We can help break this stranglehold on Congress with one good example of an honest American, someone not dependent on this special interest money, someone who is blacklisted by the all-powerful American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and establishment media, someone who is so anti-incumbent, so anti-big government, and so against the phony Democrat-Republican stage show that even many supposedly maverick Tea Party groups are afraid of him. Once we elect such a hero, the whole edifice of control by special interests will collapse. Trafficant, known for kicking the rats out of Washington, is popular, but they have smothered his 2010 congressional campaign in silence, in which he is running as an independent. So, of course, he has almost no money to buy ads, but he does have a solid base of supporters and name recognition. He can win. I am enthusiastically volunteering my services pro bono, plus contributing as much as I can to Trafficant's campaign, because it's the right thing to do. The maximum legal campaign contribution limit for each individual in a family is $2,400. The odds are against us, but those are the sweetest victories. If you understand how vitally important Trafficant's victory will be, then we will have a representative resurrected by the power of the true American people. If you, like me, are furious at Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, send a message to your Congress critter, no matter where you live, and send your support to Trafficant for Congress, 429 North Main Street, Poland, Ohio, 44514. Page 2. Personal from the editor. Newsroom numbskulls. The conventional media are so lax that they trip over themselves. Case in point, the Herald Palladium of Southwest Michigan, which stops at nothing to hide the local congressman's voting record from the public, reported that a recent scheduled debate was canceled because the Republicans had other things to do. The 6th Congressional District area, run by 12-term U.S. Representative Fred Upton, includes state representatives and senators who, in varying degrees, are beholden to Upton. Knowing this area well, I call them the Uptonians. This clique is completely insulated from real scrutiny because the local newspaper never gives any substantial, regular summary of how they vote on legislation. Moreover, the GOP has run the district for more than 4 decades. Thus, there is absolutely no urgency to debate because the clique knows it will get reelected. Absent any information that would give voters a reason to reject the Uptonians, they win every time. Politically, this area could not be more boring. This is what I call media disconnect, wherein the conventional media are so bent on giving readers Kool-Aid that the idea of serving them substantive news they can really use gets lost. This example, sadly, is probably telltale of most congressional districts, where the local member of Congress rules the roost behind a display of false modesty, even while the select few move into state legislative seats at the Congress member's behest. A major reason for this is the notion that only donkeys and elephants matter, while other political parties are belittled. This relates to ballot access laws, unfair barriers used to keep renegades out of office where they can end the Fed, repudiate the national debt, halt our no-win wars, and other things that plague us. Such regulations include signature-gathering rules that almost stopped former Democratic Ohio Congressman Jim Trafficking from seeking re-election as an independent. But he just made it. On another note, American Free Press is now offering audio versions of the entire newspaper, read by AFP's internet correspondent Dave Gahary, for download on our AmericanFreePress.net website. These are just $1 each, but are available for free to AFP Readership Council members and to AFP's online subscribers. If there is enough interest from our subscribers, we will make copies of AFP's audio editions available on CD for sale through the mail. Contact AFP's First Amendment Books Director, Olga Belenskaya, if this is something you may be interested in ordering. And I also encourage everyone to pick up a copy of Pat Shannon's new book, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. It's described on the wrapper surrounding this week's issue of AFP. Mark Anderson. News you may have missed. End may be near for Federal Reserve. The battle to expose the Federal Reserve has been long and arduous. It finally appears that after nearly 100 years of absolute economic control, the Fed's reign may be coming to an end, wrote Eric Blair on Infowars.com October 13th. With all the recent mainstream talk and speculation about the end of the Fed, it is time to debate solutions for the future of America's currency. This may indeed be the most important discussion of our lifetime. We at AFP say amen to this. By the time we reach 2013, the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act, let's repudiate the national debt and pull the plug on this monster, created on Jekyll Island, Georgia, once and for all. Foreclosure. With calls mounting for a national moratorium, Bank of America Corp. said on October 8th that it would halt the sale of foreclosed homes indefinitely in all 50 states as the nation's largest lender widens its investigation into how it seized homes from troubled borrowers. Corporate judge. A 67-year-old federal judge in Atlanta is in hot water over an unseemly relationship that he had with a stripper. At first, elderly jurist Jack D. Camp only visited his girlfriend at the local strip club, but the relationship quickly degenerated into charges of prostitution and gun-toting drug deals. Among other charges, Camp is now facing allegations that he may have used his position to influence court cases that came before his bench. Mayor aims high. Hazleton Mayor Lou Barletta made waves over the last few years by enacting city laws to combat the employment and housing of illegal aliens in his eastern Pennsylvania town. Now Barletta is running for Congress in the 11th District, earning endorsements from Gun Owners of America and Firearms Owners Against Crime. Page 15 in this AFP lists candidates who pledged to be tough on illegal immigration during their term. Bankrupt World. Standard & Poor's rating agency recently issued a report titled Global Aging 2010, An Irreversible Truth, which makes the shocking prediction that 60% of countries will be bankrupt and that the United States will have a national debt that is 415% of its GDP. Poverty increases in America. According to the latest census data, since 2000, poverty has increased by nearly 40% in 57 out of the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the United States. Equally troubling is the fact that unemployment in the major cities stands at 19.5%, almost double the 10.4% for the rest of the country. Clearly, something must be done to create jobs for Americans. Yet, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce disagrees. See our lead item in Spotlight on Congress, page 8, for more on this. Silver Swindle. Ted Butler, considered the foremost American expert on silver, says that J.P. Morgan Chase is illegally manipulating the price of the metal and that the federal regulatory agency that is supposed to prevent market manipulation, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, is looking the other way. Illegal collusion? Butler expects wild volatility in the price of silver as a result of the scheme. Say what? Cortland Malloy, a black columnist for the liberal Washington Post, believes he has solved the racism issue. If white people didn't insist on being white, he opined in a recent column, there would be no such thing as race. Key assassin arrested. The chief of police in Dubai says the Israeli assassin chiefly responsible for murdering a top Hamas politician in a United Arab Emirate hotel on January 19, 2010, has been arrested in an undisclosed foreign country and is secretly being held. Lieutenant General Dahai Khalfan Tamim made the announcement to the UAE newspaper, but refused to disclose the country where the arrest took place or the name of the Israeli operative. Page 3. AFP on the Second Amendment. Allow students to carry guns on college campuses? By James P. Tucker, Jr. Texas legislators plan to push a law that would permit college students to carry concealed weapons on campus, citing the Virginia Tech incident in 2007 when a disturbed young Asian man shot and killed 32 unarmed fellow students in one morning before committing suicide. That story was never fully explored regarding the man's strange background and the true reasons that he mercilessly attacked students. But what is known is that police were woefully tardy in responding, and many lives would have been spared if at least some students had been armed, as campus concealed weapons advocates argue. State Senator Jeff Wentworth and Representative Joe Driver are sponsoring the measure to allow students who meet certain conditions to be armed. Since the Virginia Tech incident, several copycat attackers have been stopped by armed students. Driver, Republican Garland, has filed HB 1983, while Wentworth, Republican San Antonio, has filed SB 1164. Texas enacted a concealed handgun law in 1995, allowing people 21 and older to carry concealed weapons if they pass a training course and background check. Schools, businesses, and churches, if they wish, can set rules banning guns inside their establishments. On college campuses, guns are banned in buildings, dorms, and certain grounds surrounding them. The planned legislation would impact only colleges. Lawmakers in support of allowing students to be armed appear to have a powerful ally in Republican Governor Rick Perry, though in an election year, Perry's words have to be carefully filtered. There are already guns on campus, Perry told the Associated Press. All too often they are illegal. I want there to be legal guns on campus. I think it makes sense, and all the data supports, that if law-abiding, well-trained, backgrounded individuals have a weapon, then there will be less crime. Interest in the issue erupted after a man ran around the University of Texas campus firing wildly on September 28, 2010. Colton Joshua Tooley then ran into a library and shot himself. No one else was injured. But there was a lot of discussion about how much worse it could have been. If more people carried guns, many argue, schools would be safer. There are a lot of combat veterans like me, and if we had concealed carry, the threat would be reduced significantly, said Casey Kelliver, 25, a student and Army veteran from Houston who did two tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. Instead, you're left to sit there and wait for somebody to come save you. Perry's Democratic opponent for the governor's seat, Bill White of Houston, says that he supports the state law that lets people with licenses carry concealed handguns, but individual schools should decide whether to allow guns on their premises, he said. White claimed that Perry's position is the government ought to coerce campuses to allow concealed handguns on campus. Daniel Crocker, a Texas A&M student and board member of Students for Concealed Carry on Campus, said it is absurd to have an invisible line at the edge of campus inside of which guns are forbidden. Law-abiding citizens heed the line, but criminals do not, he said. There was one fundamental problem with the September 28th incident in Austin, Crocker said. Everyone was depending on the kind and mercy of a deranged lunatic. An increasing number of campuses are allowing guns, Crocker said, but they are not the majority. His group also supports letting students defend themselves against thousands of other crimes that occur on campuses, such as rapes and robberies. Page 4. Inside the Obama administration. Cass Sunstein, radical commie czar, sees freedom of speech as dangerous. By Victor Thorne. Cass Sunstein, President Obama's regulatory czar, says Americans should celebrate Tax Day. He also feels that an economic crisis could be used to usher in socialism and that cloning is justifiable because embryos are just a handful of cells. Furthermore, he views the Constitution as a pesky document. As another of Obama's Chicago cronies, Sunstein heads the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA, where he not only oversees all congressional laws, but also has the power to rewrite them. Sunstein proclaims that our rights aren't divinely granted, but instead are derived from the government. In an April 14, 1999 Chicago Tribune article, Sunstein proclaimed, "Without taxes, there would be no liberty. Without taxes, there would be no property. Without taxes, few of us would have any assets worth defending." Certainly, many patriotic Americans disagree with Sunstein, but this czar characterizes them as conspiracy theorists and fully supports using shadow agencies that use infiltration and disruption techniques to keep track of anyone who believes government is way too big. During a September 15th interview with American Free Press, Todd Fletcher, a research assistant for Professor David Ray Griffin's book, Cognitive Infiltration, told this AFP writer, "In a 2008 paper for the Journal of Political Philosophy entitled Conspiracy Theories, Causes and Cures, Sunstein called for a secret government operation that would break up groups of hardcore extremists who supply anti-government conspiracy theories." Fletcher continued, "Because Sunstein believes that these people, many of them 9/11 truthers, exist in a realm of informational isolation, they're more likely to become violent and dangerous and engage in forms of terrorism. Thus, federal agents should undermine their ranks and regulate the internet." Although Sunstein has acknowledged that our government in the past has engaged in some illegal and nefarious conspiracies, it still doesn't prevent him from condoning a host of Nixon-style dirty tricks. As Fletcher noted, people who commit evil acts on a systemic basis find ways to rationalize their behavior. Elitists behind the scenes have a twisted set of values, and they don't give a damn about the truth. Wielding control over bank bailouts, health care, and potential cap-and-trade legislation, Sunstein may eventually be rewarded a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Such a move could prove disastrous, for he recently mocked the Constitution's legitimacy as follows. "Some conservative legal thinkers like Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas think that the Constitution means what it originally meant. He supports bypassing this document in order to appoint an authoritarian superpower president." Sunstein even goes a step further. "There is no reason to believe that federal law should be settled by the inclinations and predispositions of federal judges. The outcome should instead depend on the commitments and beliefs of the president and those who operate under him." Sunstein's disregard for the separation of powers extends to his views on a free press. Sunstein advocates the creation of a government panel that would outlaw segregation, independence, for broadcasters. His fairness doctrine is explained in his 1995 book, Democracy and the Problem of Free Speech. This title reflects Sunstein's lack of respect for everyday Americans, who he compares to the cartoon character Homer Simpson, the obese, insipid father of the famous Simpsons cartoon. Therefore, to compensate for our apparent inability to make proper decisions, Sunstein promoted a Big Brother concept called behavioral economics in his 2008 book, Nudge. In it, he wrote, "It's the government's role to help people make choices in their daily lives. Human life has even less value to him." Echoing the sordid practice of organ stealing, Sunstein boldly declared in Nudge, "The state owns the rights to body parts of people who are dead or in certain hopeless conditions, and it can remove their organs without asking anyone's permission." Similarly, death panels would be instituted to determine medical rationing or quality-adjusted life years for elderly citizens, while the federal government would fund abortions. Says Sunstein, "A restriction on access to abortion turns women's reproductive capacities into something to be used by fetuses." Peter Singer, one of Sunstein's mentors, found it morally permissible to engage in the infanticide of disabled toddlers if it was in the best interests of the baby and the family. Matrimony is frowned upon. Under our proposal, the word marriage would no longer appear in any laws, and marriage licenses would no longer be offered or recognized by any level of government, Sunstein wrote. From Sunstein's perspective, the primary reason America hasn't become even more socialistic is due to the white population's deep-seated racism. The absence of a European-style social welfare state is certainly connected with the widespread perception among the white majority that the relevant programs would disproportionately benefit African Americans, he wrote. An Obama-like version of distributive justice would likewise be implemented under the guise of cap-and-trade legislation. In a 2007 essay, Sunstein confirmed that a desirable redistribution of wealth from the United States to poorer nations is more likely to occur through climate change policy than otherwise. Caption. In May this year, the website www.warcrimes.com reported that in a disturbing audio, White House information czar Cass Sunstein, who in a previous white paper called for banning conspiracy theories, demanded that websites be mandated by law to link to opposing information, or that pop-ups containing government propaganda be forcibly included on political blogs. Page 6, Spotlight on Big Brother, Inside the Biggest Internet Swindle of the Century, by Ralph Forbes. In ongoing articles, American Free Press has shown that the online social networking site Facebook, like Google, has financial links with the CIA and other intelligence agencies, in particular Israel's Mossad, as part of an all-knowing global computer conglomeration contrived to mimic, in the words of Google's Serge Brin, the mind of God. When the federal government's Total Information Awareness, TIA, and other police state operations were stopped by public outrage after AFP helped expose these schemes, the CIA found the perfect vehicle to put a smiley face on the TIA tyranny in the guise of Facebook. But would Facebook be a harmless online social network, even if it were free of CIA manipulation? Behind Facebook's mask, social networking websites have taken off in the past few years. It refers to the process of utilizing databases to help foster relationships among people with similar ideas or interests. In 2002, Divya Narendra had a brilliant idea for a social networking site. Joining quickly with Harvard schoolmates, twin brothers Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, they began something called ConnectU. By the fall of 2003, they needed a programmer to finish developing their idea, so they eventually hired another student, Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg, or Zuck for short, never finished their job, but instead made it his own and registered an application that became Facebook. Feeling a bit cheated, less than a week after Zuckerberg launched his site, the three who had hired Zuckerberg sued him for stealing their ideas to build a competing product. After a long trek through the courts, the three agreed to accept a $65 million settlement, part of which was preferred stock. At present, there is a securities fraud action claiming that Zuckerberg fraudulently performed the payoff in common stock worth only a fraction of the settlement. Facebook itself valued its common shares at roughly 75% less than preferred shares. Zuckerberg has a less than stellar record. He was charged with breaching security, violating copyrights, and violating individual privacy, according to the Harvard Crimson's November 19, 2003 edition. AFP has learned what was found buried in Zuckerberg's computers, but sealed by secret agreement. These leaks have not been confirmed by Zuckerberg or Facebook, but this writer trusts his sources and believes them to be true and accurate. The evidence shows Zuck hacked into ConnectU's account verification process to create a fake Cameron Winklevoss account with a fake Harvard.edu email address. In this new fake profile, Cameron's height was listed as 7 feet 4 inches, his hair color as Aryan blonde, and his eye color as sky blue. Cameron's language was listed as WASPy. Zuck also apparently sabotaged scores of key accounts and made ConnectU buggy instead of perfecting it as he agreed to do. On December 7, 2003, Zuckerberg via email bragged to his Harvard classmate and Facebook co-founder, Eduardo Saverin. They made a mistake, haha. They asked me to make it for them, so I'm delaying it so it won't be ready until after the Facebook thing comes out. Another message said, I feel like the right thing to do is finish the Facebook and wait until the last day before I'm supposed to have their thing ready and then be like, look, yours isn't as good. Here are some other shocking excerpts of the correspondence. Zuck. Unless I expletive deleted the dating site people over and quit on them right before I told them I'd have it done. Adam D'Angelo, who later became Facebook's chief technology officer. Ha ha. Zuck, the thing is they have a programmer who could finish their thing and they have money to pour into advertising and stuff. Oh wait, I have money too. My friend who wants to sponsor this is head of the investment society. Apparently insider trading isn't illegal in Brazil, so he's rich, LOL, meaning laughing out loud. Zuck's friend Eduardo also moved on to a high-paying internship at Lehman Brothers before the big banker's TARP scam. D'Angelo, LOL. Friend, so have you decided what you're going to do about the websites? Zuck, yeah, I'm going to expletive deleted them. That's more than enough excerpts to get the picture. Former PayPal CEO Peter Thiel began the first formal Facebook financing in September 2004 with a $500,000 investment at a $5 million valuation. Once Facebook showed its potential, the CIA used your tax dollars to make Facebook another Big Brother spy on you asset and to make Zuckerberg worth almost $7 billion. So even if there were no CIA connections, would you buy a car from Zuckerberg or have an association with him at all? Then why in the name of sanity do a half billion people willingly turn over the keys to their kingdom to an operation run by the conniving, foul-mouthed Zuckerberg and his ilk? Page 8, AFP's spotlight on Congress. Lobbyists killed jobs bill. U.S. Chamber of Commerce lobbyists fight to keep jobs overseas. A series of mainstream media reports have revealed how the U.S. Chamber of Commerce recently mobilized its army of lobbyists to fight Senate legislation that would bring once outsourced jobs back home to the U.S. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is a nonprofit 501c6 that purportedly works to promote businesses and jobs in America. Today, however, the organization is increasingly coming under fire for backing multinational corporations and the outsourcing of American jobs to third world countries. The bill in question was the Creating American Jobs and End Offshoring Act, S-3816, sponsored by Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois. According to Senator Bernie Sanders, independent Vermont, one of the bill's co-sponsors, the measure would put an end to the assistance Washington has been giving big business to move American jobs overseas. Among other things, it gives companies a 2-year payroll tax break when they hire new employees to perform services in the United States that had previously been done abroad. It also eliminates a tax break, corporate subsidy, that companies get for closing down factories and moving them abroad. Says Sanders, the bill prohibits a firm from taking any deduction, loss, or credit for the amounts paid in connection with reducing or ending the operation of a trade or business in the U.S. and starting or expanding a similar trade or business overseas. Finally, the bill closes down a federal tax subsidy that has been rewarding U.S. companies that move their factories to foreign lands. Under current law, says Sanders, U.S. companies can defer paying U.S. tax on income earned by their foreign subsidiaries until that income is brought back to the United States. This is known as deferral and puts American companies at a distinct disadvantage because they are responsible for taxes no matter whether they sell their wares or not. At a time when unemployment is at a record high, the bill should have been a no-brainer for legislators when it came up for a vote. But only 8 senators sponsored it, all Democrats except for Sanders, a Vermont independent. But even worse, neither Democrats nor Republicans could get the 60 votes necessary to pass a cloture bill to get it to the floor for a vote. That's because the Chamber of Commerce, which donates heavily to Republicans and Democrats, came down hard against it. This should not come as a surprise, considering it has been revealed that the Chamber of Commerce has been receiving significant funding from companies in foreign countries. According to the left-wing populist organization Think Progress, the Chamber has been accepting millions of dollars tax-free from companies in China, India, Bahrain, Egypt, and Russia, among other countries, and then funneling that money into U.S. political campaigns in violation of federal election law. In return, the Chamber has become a vocal proponent of globalism, which includes sending U.S. jobs abroad and hiring cheap labor. In a letter to Congress, U.S. Chamber of Commerce President Bruce Jostin displayed his complete incompetence, his disdain for American workers, and his utter lack of patriotism by claiming that bringing much-needed jobs back to the United States would not really help the U.S. economy. Replacing a job that is based in another country with a domestic job does not stimulate economic growth or enhance the competitiveness of American worldwide companies, Jostin scribbled. So what does Jostin suggest Congress do to help Main Street America and boost the economy? He says Congress should make permanent the tax breaks for the 2% of the American population that earns more than $250,000 a year. The insanity of Jostin's claims is revealed in the fact that consumer spending accounts for 70% of the U.S. economy. In plain English, that means if there are no jobs for working-class Americans, there is no more United States. Obama vetoes bill, helps homeowners. Just when you think Washington has learned its lesson about the thieves and liars on Wall Street, legislation rockets through Congress, making it easy for the banks to steal your home. The innocuously named Interstate Recognition of Notarizations Act, H.R. 3808, quietly sailed through the House and the Senate this year without raising any eyebrows. The craven House passed it by voice vote in the spring, while the Senate passed it without amendment by unanimous consent. a cowardly way of passing controversial legislation without having to attach any senator's name to it. Americans must thank President Obama for vetoing this malicious legislation. Little did America know, but the bill would have made it a piece of cake for banks to foreclose on anyone's home. The big bankers would not even have to show up for court if a homeowner attempts to contest the foreclosure. Instead, all a banker would have to do is submit paperwork to the courts, and he wouldn't even have to get it notarized in the state in which the home or the hearing is located. The fact that it was caught at the last minute does not make Washington look any better, though, given the funny business bankers have been engaged in lately when it comes to taking homes from Americans who are down on their luck. Clearly, Congress is still in bed with the bankers. They just don't want you to know about it. Wall Street owns House and Senate. If anyone had any doubt who owns Congress, it's evident by a new report detailing how Wall Street has been handing out lots of cash to those who introduce and vote on measures that eventually become law of the land. A study by the independent magazine Mother Jones found that, while AT&T may be the top giver, financial firms make up almost half of the top 10 corporate donors to Congress. Wall Street's most generous givers are all household names. They include Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, the American Bankers Association, and the National Realtors Association. How much money are we talking about here? In the past 20 years, financial, insurance, and real estate firms gave almost $2.5 billion to congressional candidates. A hodgepodge of manufacturing companies, grocery store chains, and breweries came in a distant second with less than $1.5 billion. Page 9, AFP on the foreclosure crisis. Foreclosure Gate and the President's Pocket Veto by Ellen Brown. Amid a snowballing foreclosure fraud crisis, President Obama on October 7th blocked legislation that could have made it more difficult for homeowners to challenge foreclosure proceedings against them. In a maneuver known as a pocket veto, Obama indirectly vetoed the legislation by declining to sign the bill passed by Congress while the legislators were on recess. Mr. Obama's action follows an announcement that Wall Street banks are voluntarily suspending foreclosure proceedings in 23 states. It seems voluntary suspension of foreclosure is underway to review simple procedural errors that the conscientious banks are allegedly hastening to correct. However, those errors actually conceal a massive fraud and cannot be corrected with legitimate paperwork, which is why the servicers had to hire foreclosure mills to fabricate the documents. These errors involve perjury and forgery. Carl Denninger at MarketTicker is calling it Foreclosure Gate. The name fits. Three large mortgage issuers, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and GMAC, have voluntarily suspended thousands of foreclosures, and a number of calls have been made for investigations. Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray is filing suit against Ally Financial and GMAC for civil penalties of up to $25,000 per violation for fraud in hundreds of foreclosure suits. These problems cannot be swept under the rug. They go to the heart of the securitization process itself. The snowball has just started to roll. Eve Smith of Naked Capitalism has uncovered a price list from a company called DocX that specializes in document recovery solutions. DocX is the technology platform used by lender processing services to manage a national network of foreclosure mills. The price list includes such things as Create Missing Intervening Assignment, $35. Cure Defective Assignment, $12.95, and Recreate Entire Collateral File, $95. Note Smith, creating means fabricating documents out of whole cloth. And look at the extent of the offerings. The collateral file is all the documents the trustee, or the custodian as an agent of the trustee, needs to have pursuant to its obligations under the pooling and servicing agreement on behalf of the mortgage-backed security holder. This means, most importantly, the original of the note, the borrower IOU, copies of the mortgage, the lien on the property, the securitization agreement, and title insurance. All of the mortgages in question were securitized, meaning they were turned into mortgage-backed securities, MBS, and sold off to investors. MBS are typically pooled through a type of special purpose vehicle called a Real Estate Mortgage Investment Conduit, or REMIC, which has strict requirements defined under the U.S. Internal Revenue Code, the Tax Reform Act of 1986. The REMIC holds the mortgages in trust and issues securities representing an undivided interest in them. The mortgages, experts say, are pooled into REMIC trusts as a tax avoidance measure, and that to qualify, the properties must be properly conveyed to the trustee of the REMIC in the year the MBS is set up, with all the paperwork necessary to show a complete chain of title. For some reason, however, that was not done, and there is no legitimate way to create those conveyances now, because the time limit allowed under the tax code has passed. Why weren't they done properly in the first place? Struggling Americans deserve answers. Page 10. AFP and the Global Elite. EU on Verge of Economic Collapse by James P. Tucker, Jr. Bilderberg luminaries were outspoken in their demands for a world government at the October 11, 2010 IMF meeting at the World Bank, and they plan to further advance their cause at the November summit of the United States and European Union. But, as has been the case in recent years, Bilderberg grumpily acknowledged setbacks. IMF and World Bank luminary Joa Valle de Almeida, who heads the EU's delegation to the United States, had this to say to the Bilderberg-controlled Washington Post on October 9th. Commentators have been quick to lump together a series of ailments: rising nationalism, deficits, high unemployment, and a declining euro, and declare that the European Union is dying, if not already dead. So, how should the global governors fight back? He called for comprehensive financial stabilization mechanisms and the launching of revamped economic governance mechanisms. There will be a need for further coordination that only a robust European Union can provide at the European level in launching an ambitious revamping of economic governance. He added, at the EU-US summit in November, this will probably be one of the main topics. His constant references to economic governance and denunciations of nationalism echo Bilderberg's long sought-after goal of creating a world government through the United Nations. During the Bilderberg meeting last spring, participants called for a World Treasury Department and pledged to keep the economic recession going through 2011 to induce public acceptance of such structures. The Washington Post gave Almeida this space because it supports the cause of Bilderberg. Every Post publisher since 1954 has attended Bilderberg meetings on a solemn, well-kept promise of absolute secrecy and to advocate its goals. So much for freedom of the press. The Bilderberg Group, which started meeting in 1954, is an annual closed-door confab of heads of state, media moguls, financial titans, and corporate leaders. Their secretive meetings take place at posh resorts around the world and are guarded by heavily armed police and private security. It's a world planning session where sweeping policy goals are discussed outside the democratic process, goals that later can be sold to the public through selective media channels and legislation modeled on Bilderberg goals. These elitists tend to get their way, but this AFP writer has spent years tailing and exposing them. Thanks to publicity, Bilderberg setbacks persist. Free trade has long been a major Bilderberg goal as a means of integrating the world economy. In 1999, only 30% of Americans thought free trade hurt this country. Now, 53% say it hurts this country. Among Tea Party participants and labor union members, opposition to free trade is above 60%. In efforts to integrate nations in this hemisphere into an American Union, similar to the European Union, Bilderberg strongly defends illegal immigration. Notably, the delegation of the European Union to the United States facilitates relations between the EU and the United States and is located at 2175 K Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Though technically not an embassy, its head has ambassador status. Almeida assumed that post in February 2010. Caption: President Barack Obama poses with IMF and World Bank luminary Almeida, who heads the EU's delegation to the United States. In other words, a stooge of the global elite. Social Credit, A National Dividend for the Common Man by Mark Anderson. Three economists just won the 2010 Nobel Prize for Economics. Having flexed their vast intellects, they accepted the $1.5 million prize. Federal Reserve Board nominee Peter Diamond will piously divide the dough with fellow American economist Dale Mortensen and Britain's Christopher Psarides. Not bad money for distorting the obvious. Meanwhile, the American Monetary Institute, AMI, just concluded its annual Chicago conference and made some special announcements. While touching on proposed solutions, let's compare these two developments as economic tremors continue to shake the world, especially the U.S., and decide which one really deserves publicity. Rebuttal to Nobel crowd. The Associated Press, AP, like usual, heralded the Nobel Prize story, saying, "Their work sheds light on why the classical view of markets, in which prices are set so that buyers and sellers always find each other and all resources are fully utilized, doesn't always apply to the real world." AP adds, "One example is the housing market, where buyers can struggle to find new homes, even though there are a number of unsold properties available. This is a classic case of establishment types, the Nobel Committee that chooses prize winners, prize recipients, and big media sustaining economic confusion, knowingly or not, while acting as if they are pointing the way to economic salvation. You don't have to attend the stuffy London School of Economics like Pissarides did to understand that the real world in economics always pertains to buyers and sellers, as well as producers, and that buyers and sellers will always find each other if enough purchasing power is in the hands of consumers, many of whom are also capable of being producers. But their middle-class jobs were destroyed, mainly by the North American Free Trade Agreement, a modern Trojan horse that these Nobel eggheads dare not mention." AP also said buyers struggle to find new homes, even when unsold homes cluttered the landscape. But some wannabe buyers hoping to move are struggling to sell their old homes to others who cannot get credit, lost good jobs, and or depleted their savings. Today, many buyers lack the employment income and savings to get an adequate down payment so they can afford a home in the first place. Buyers are struggling to afford new homes, not struggling to find them. Solutions on deck. The social credit movement has lots to say about these matters. Having studied social credit, MichaelJournal.org, and AMI's similar ideas, Monetary.org, closely, this writer can state that our central banking masters and their monopoly on producing debt money, done by attaching interest to money's creation, must be dethroned, so money can be produced interest-free as a sovereign act of government. In doing so, furnishing a national dividend to all citizens as a non-welfare means of supplying purchasing power that is not tied to labor is a critical step. Some AFP readers like this idea, while others say it sounds like welfare, and that money can only come from the pride of one's work. No problem with the pride, of course. But be assured that a national dividend is a logical, freedom-enhancing way to provide debt purchasing power based on each citizen's sovereign existence in the Commonwealth, on the basis of natural resources, inventions, and know-how of succeeding generations. The dividends from today's private creation of money and private possession of credit, two things that should belong only to the public, have been channeled to the bankers, like a water system that would normally branch out across the nation to serve everyone. But it's like a huge banker's dam that has been built near the source so all the water circulates in a limited area. Only a trickle is allowed to flow onward to the masses. This analogy shows that all the dividends are pooled for the benefit of the narrow minority that owns and runs the banking system. This racket has conditioned people to accept the false notion that endless labor or welfare are the only ways to eat and live, as we are forced to beg, borrow, and steal over that trickle which remains. We need such dividends to flow to all, not to the chosen few, with no debt created in the process. So, the cure for the troubled housing market and other sectors lies in boosting purchasing power with this national dividend and a return of U.S. industry. Both are needed, but since every new job creates additional labor costs that end up in the price tag of products and services, the dividend kicks in, so people can combine their dividends with job earnings, prices stabilize. That means more free time because they are not totally dependent on the workforce welfare treadmill, where the bankers have consigned the commoners to slave their entire lives in a debtor's prison without bars. Also, since each person's dividend amount is based on overall production, and because automation can produce an excess of goods, individual purchasing power would increase, even if less labor is required. Someone please alert the Nobel nerds that this means no more full stores and empty wallets, and no more empty houses because of empty wallets. Meanwhile, the AMI is reporting much more useful information than the AP ignores. This concerns the American Monetary Act, monetary reform legislation developed over several years by the AMI, which is led by noted author Stephen Zarlenga. An AMI news bulletin noted that Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat, Ohio, told AMI conference attendees by video feed that he wants to introduce a monetary reform bill sometime this fall. Another significant AMI development in Chicago was a Japanese professor's presentation. Professor Kaoru Yamaguchi, who earned his economics doctorate at UC Berkeley and is now a professor at the Doshisha University in Kyoto, presented his macroeconomic analysis analysis of the American Monetary Act using an advanced system dynamics approach that showed very positive results, AMI's bulletin added. This is a very big deal. Economists will now have to look beyond their dysfunctional Keynesian and opposing economic systems, using debt for money, and carefully examine the American Monetary Act, which institutes debt-free money. We welcome this development. The professor said implementing the AMA will pay off the national debt without inflation, that it allows for the kind of growth needed in promoting jobs through fixing U.S. infrastructure, and that using debt-free money is the correct option for solving this crisis. Page 11, AFP on the stock market. Big players moving money out of stocks and into gold, by Pat Shannon. There are some ominous signs alerting us that something is just not right in the world's financial markets, but no one can define what has provoked the current strange behavior of the behind-the-scenes big boy players right now. Market watchers tell us that corporate insiders are bailing out the U.S. stock market at an alarming rate and are moving their funds into gold, with such a strong demand as to cause gold shortages in some countries. In particular, at the time of this writing, someone is making some incredibly large bets that the S&P 500 is going to absolutely tank this fall, perhaps before October ends. If things are going to go south, entrenched insiders will know before anyone else. Therefore, their activity is where we will find the first signs that something dreadful is coming. Consider the following, drawn from recent financial reports by this AFP writer. Corporate insiders are getting out of the U.S. stock market at a blinding pace. The ratio of corporate insider selling to corporate insider buying at the end of September was 1,411 to 1, and the following week the ratio soared even higher to 2,341 to 1. Many of the world's wealthiest people are buying massive quantities of gold right now. Financial conglomerate J.P. Morgan Chase is gobbling up the rights to as much physical gold as it can. The United States Mint has announced that it has run out of 1 ounce 24-carat American Buffalo gold bullion coins and will sell no more of them this year. It is becoming increasingly difficult to explain the unusually high option volume that we are witnessing right now. Why are these very large investors making massive bets that the S&P 500 is going to take a serious tumble during the month of October? On October 5th, the Bank of Japan shocked world financial markets by cutting interest rates even closer to zero and by setting up a 5 trillion yen quantitative easing fund, an increase of reserves for loans. Quantitative easing refers to the process of increasing the money supply by purchasing bonds and other securities from banks, which increases banks' reserves, allowing them to create more debt. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York's president and Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago's president are publicly urging the Fed to do much more to stimulate the U.S. economy, including beginning a new round of quantitative easing, even if it means a significant rise in the U.S. inflation rate. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz told the media that the loose monetary policies of the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank are throwing the world into chaos. At the end of September, federal regulators announced a $30 billion bailout of the U.S. wholesale credit union system. This has been the federal band-aid applied to the terminal cancer for years, and the patient is now on its deathbed. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and GMAC Mortgage have all suspended foreclosures in many states due to serious concerns about procedures. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott is demanding that all Texas mortgage servicing companies immediately suspend all foreclosures, the selling of foreclosed properties, and the eviction of people living in foreclosed properties until they have completed a review of their foreclosure procedures. Meanwhile, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat California, and 30 other members of Congress at the national level want to probe the foreclosure practices of U.S. mortgage lenders. While foreclosure companies being investigated is good news, the controversy has a potential to turn the entire U.S. mortgage industry into an absolute quagmire. More financial reporters are agreeing every week that a collapse appears inevitable. The U.S. economy is undeniably in decline, but nobody seems to know when. In the months and years to come, the major players are going to try hard to keep all the balls in the air and to continue the massive shell game that is going on. But in the end, the whole thing is going to collapse like a house of cards. Page 12, Inside the Obama Administration. Idea Obama is cleaning house of Zionists is charade, by Victor Thorne. Rahm Emanuel and other prominent Jewish administration members, including David Axelrod, Lawrence Summers, and Peter Orszag, are fleeing the failed Obama presidency like rats from a sinking ship. Sensing that his usefulness has been served, Israel is none too subtly turning its back on Obama. In this light, the president hasn't courageously cleaned house, nor does he have the backbone to challenge his Zionist backers. Far from being a hero, Obama is a pathological narcissist. As the shallowest of empty suits devoid of any concern for traditional America, Obama's passions don't extend past ESPN, golfing, or shooting hoops. If the vast majority of American presidents have been nothing more than puppets on a string, why believe that the weakest leader we've had in modern times would suddenly lash out at his elitist controllers? Obama isn't John F. Kennedy, and he doesn't naively possess a death wish. He knows that a genuine challenge to his overlords would create the need for a radical Muslim lone nut patsy gunman. In today's world, staged political battles are showcased for the public as if they're real. Mystery shrouds Obama's entire life, including the identity of his father, his actual birthplace, and a contrived college career. Obama does not appear to have ever attended Columbia University. Rather, it looks as though CIA officials had recruited him during the Soviet-Afghanistan War to assist in their drug-running and money-laundering operations. He's one of them, a made member of the club. At Harvard, his handlers appointed him editor of the prestigious Harvard Law Review, even though Obama never published a single article. To bolster his credibility, whether underground domestic terrorist turned Illinois professor William Ayers entered the picture to ghostwrite his autobiography. Obama, a.k.a. Barry Sotero, would never stand up to Israel or the Hyde Park University of Chicago political machine. It was that group that turned him into a Manchurian candidate, catapulting him from the Illinois State Senate to the U.S. Senate to the presidency in a brief time period. Moreover, Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu views Obama as weak. When seen in public, our president resembles a shrinking violet in Bibi's presence, a teleprompter-addicted stumble-bum being led by the nose. Israel's lack of respect for Obama became so pronounced that they boycotted his September 23rd United Nations address. Netanyahu further humiliated Obama by requesting a pardon for Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard in return for a phony freeze on settlement construction in Israeli-occupied Palestine. Netanyahu, in a letter, also rejected overtures by Obama. The letter's contents were leaked by the Institute for Near East Policy's David Makovsky, who is an associate of neoconservative Dennis Ross. The letter, penned by Ross and Yitzhak Molko, allowed Israel to maintain a military presence in the West Bank, continue their control of Palestinian borders, and ensure Israel is provided with high-tech weaponry and billions in foreign aid. Liberal critics blasted Obama's offer. The only concession he requested of Netanyahu was a 2-month freeze on the expansion of Israeli settlements. Bibi declined because they had never halted construction on Palestinian land anyway. Hardcore Likud members like Lieberman don't even attempt to hide their contempt for peace talks with Arab neighbors. Why should they? Obama won't punish Israel. Congress is governed by the Israel lobby, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas acts as a double agent for his Zionist masters. It's all a charade. So is the notion of peace President Obama, as 50,000 troops remain in Iraq, even while he has pushed war efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan beyond those of the Bush administration. In light of recent FBI raids, Obama has betrayed Muslims, Palestinians, and peace activists to the Israelis. Although U.S. Mideast policy is overseen by Ross and Dan Shapiro, some credit Obama for bucking Israel because he hasn't yet allowed them to bomb Iran, but neither did Bush and Cheney. The main reason we haven't permitted this insanity is due to our military retaining an ounce of common sense. Obama doesn't deserve accolades, for he'd never confront Israel even if he so desired. The reason is obvious. The skeletons in his closet are too damning. With the power of the Jewish-owned media shaping public opinion, a spurned Israel could expose Larry Sinclair's allegations of a tryst with Obama, alleged criminal dealings with imprisoned bagman Tony Resco, etc. When Obama was selected to become president, success depended on his salesmanship abilities. However, the American public saw through his ruse. Now viewed by many as an ineffectual socialist phony, his script may currently include huge Democratic losses in November, making him a lame duck one-term president. This would open the door for a staunchly pro-Israel GOP candidate, insane enough to attack Iran. Obama shouldn't be seen as leading a rebellion against America's Zionist power structure. Rather, he's another impotent actor in a twisted, staged play where Israeli saboteurs play both sides against the middle to their lasting benefit. Page 14, AFP on illegal immigration. 158 candidates will fight amnesty. by Lewis Thomas McFadden. Americans for Legal Immigration Political Action Committee, ALIPAC, which endorses candidates for Congress and Senate who oppose any form of amnesty or taxpayer benefits for illegal aliens, reports that 158 candidates currently running for office in the upcoming midterm elections are willing to fight illegal immigration. This is a hot topic while Arizona's SB 1070 faces federal lawsuits. That law made it a state crime for illegal aliens to be in Arizona. Here are ALIPAC's endorsed candidates. All challengers are running as Republicans. Alabama, U.S. Senate, Richard Shelby. U.S. House, Mike Rogers, 3rd. Robert Adderholt, 4th. Mo Brooks, challenger, 5th. And Spencer Bacus, 6th. Alaska, Senate, Joe Miller, challenger. Arizona, House, Trent Franks, 2nd. Janet Contreras, challenger, 4th. And Jesse Kelly, challenger, 8th. Arkansas Senate, John Boozman, challenger. California House, Wally Herger, 2nd. Dan Lundgren, 3rd. Tom McClintock, 4th. Paul Smith, challenger, 5th. Gary Clift, challenger, 10th. Dave Chapman, challenger, 14th. Kevin McCarthy, 22nd. Elton Gallegly, 24th. Howard McKean, 25th. Mark Reed, challenger, 27th. Ed Royce, 40th. Gary Miller, 42nd. Scott Fulkins, challenger, 43rd. Ken Calvert, 44th. Dana Rohrbacker, 46th. Daryl Issa, 49th. Brian Bilbray, 50th. Duncan D. Hunter, Jr., 52nd. And Michael Crimmins, 53rd. Colorado Senate, Ken Buck, challenger. House, Doug Lamborn, 5th. Mike Kaufman, 6th. Delaware House, Glenn Urquhart, challenger, 1st. Florida House, Cliff Stern, 6th. John Micah, 7th. Gus Bilirakis, 9th. Dennis Ross, open seat, 12th. Vern Buchanan, 13th. Tom Rooney, 16th. Alan B. West, challenger, 22nd. Bernard Sensorik, challenger, 23rd. And Sandy Adams, challenger, 24th. Georgia Senate, Johnny Isaacson. House, Jack Kingston, 1st. Lynn Westmoreland, 3rd. Thomas Price, 6th. Jim Marshall, 8th. Paul Brown, 10th. Phil Gingrey, 11th. John Barrow, 12th. And Mike Crane, challenger, 13th. Illinois House, Isaac Hayes, challenger, 2nd. Peter Roskam, 6th. Joe Walsh, 8th. Terry Navis Newman, challenger, 12th. And Tim Johnson, 15th. Indiana House, Joe Donnelly, 2nd. And Dan Burton, 5th. Iowa Senate, Charles Grassley, incumbent. House, Ben Lang, challenger, 1st. And Steve King, 5th. Kansas House, Lynn Jenkins, 2nd. Kentucky House, Edward Whitfield, 1st. Jeff Davis, 4th. And Harold Rogers, 5th. Louisiana Senate, David Vitter, incumbent. House, Steve Calise, 1st. John C. Fleming, Jr., 4th. And Rodney Alexander, 5th. Maryland House, Roscoe Bartlett, 6th. Massachusetts Senate, Scott Brown. House, Jeffrey D. Perry, 10th. Michigan House, John Kopech, challenger, 5th. Andrew Rocky Raskowski, 9th. And Don Volerich, challenger, 12th. Minnesota House, Michelle Bachman, 6th, and Lee Byberg, challenger, 7th. Mississippi House, Greg Harper, 3rd, and Gene Taylor, 4th. Missouri House, Robin Hamlin, challenger, 1st, Todd Aiken, 2nd, Sam Graves, 6th, Joanne Emerson, 8th, and Blaine Luchtmeyer, 9th. Montana House, Dennis Denny Reberg, at large. Nebraska House, Jeff Fortenberry, 1st, and Adrian Smith, 3rd. Nevada Senate, Sharon Angle, challenger. House, Dean Heller, 2nd. New Jersey House, Scott Garrett, 5th. Anna Little, challenger, 6th. And Rodney Frelinghuysen, 11th. New Mexico House, Tom Mullins, challenger, 3rd. New York Senate, Jay Townsend, challenger. House, Peter King, 3rd. And Ted Danz, challenger, 21st. North Carolina House, Walter Jones, 3rd. William B.J. Lawson, challenger, 4th. Howard Coble, 6th. Mike McIntyre, 7th. Sue Myrick, 9th. Patrick McHenry, 10th. And William Bill Randall, challenger, 13th. Ohio House, Gene Schmidt, 2nd. Jim Jordan, 4th. Robert Latta, 5th. And Bob Gibbs, challenger, 18th. Oklahoma Senate, Tom Coburn. House, John Sullivan, 1st. Oregon House, Greg Walden, 2nd. Delia Lopez, challenger, 3rd. And Pete DeFazio, 4th. Pennsylvania House, Jim Gerlach, 6th. Bill Schuster, 9th.
Tom Marino, Challenger 10th. Lou Barletta, Challenger 11th. Dee Adcock, Challenger 13th. Charlie Dent, 15th. Tim Murphy, 18th. And Todd Platts, 19th. Rhode Island, House. John J. Laughlin, open seat, 1st. South Carolina, Senate. Jim DeMint, House. Joe Wilson, 2nd. South Dakota, Senate. Jim Thune. Tennessee, House. Phil Rowe, 1st. John Duncan, 2nd. David Hall, Challenger, 5th. Diane Black, open seat, 6th. And Marsha Blackburn, 7th. Texas, House. Louis Gohmert, 1st. Ted Poe, 2nd. Sam Johnson, 3rd. Ralph Hall, 4th. Joe Barton, 6th. John Culberson, 7th. Michael McCall, 10th. Ron Paul, 14th. John Falk, Challenger, 18th. Randy Neugebauer, 19th. Lamar Smith, 21st. Pete Olson, 22nd. Kenny Marchant, 24th. Donna Campbell, Challenger, 25th. Michael Burgess, 26th. Brian Underwood, Challenger, 28th. John Carter, 31st. And Pete Sessions, 32nd. Utah Senate, Mike Lee, Challenger. House, Bob Bishop, 1st. And Joseph Chaffetz, 3rd. Virginia House, Robert Whitman, 1st. Randy Forbes, 4th. Robert Goodlatte, 6th. And Morgan Griffith, Challenger, 9th. Washington Senate, Dino Rossi, Challenger. House, John Koster, Challenger, 2nd. West Virginia House, Shelley Moore Capito, 2nd. Wisconsin House, James Sensenbrenner, 5th. Page 15, Eye on Israel. U.S. Government Funds Global Israeli Arms Industry, by Richard Walker. Over the years, Washington has bankrolled Israel's arms industry, helping to make it a major global player. At the same time, Washington's under-the-table gifts of weapons have increased the size of Israel's arsenal, even as Israel aids China and various pariah states militarily. Washington's recognition that arms are at the core of Israel's political machine was evident when the Obama White House recently included a secret arms deal as one of its incentives to encourage Israel to end its theft of Arab lands. The deal was signed to get Israel to sit down with the Palestinians. In all its dealings with Washington, Israel has consistently demanded money, guns, and missiles in return for its role in talks about the creation of an independent Palestinian state. On a more profound level, the Israeli arms industry has been so interlinked with the Israeli government that it has helped shape the country's foreign policy over several decades. A recent example of that was the 2009 diplomatic trip to 5 African nations by Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. One of the trip's remarkable features, which hinted at its real purpose, was the presence of a sizable contingent of arms industry representatives on Lieberman's plane. One of the countries visited was Nigeria, which has used its considerable oil revenues to buy close to $600 million in arms from Israel. Most of Nigeria's oil profits are controlled by a corrupt elite. Little is spent on improving the lives of the poor. After Lieberman returned to Israel, claiming he had gone to Africa to assist nations dealing with hunger and water purification, Israeli author and journalist Yossi Melman wrote a scathing article about the trip, saying its real aims were to promote Israel's arms industry and secretly establish links with the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad. He claimed that Mossad operated in some African nations, presumably the ones buying weapons, thanks to CIA cash channeled to Israel's Labor Federation. In effect, the CIA was paying Mossad agents to operate in Africa, posing as humanitarians. Israel's role in Africa has often been ignored, but it has been significant because it has supplied weapons to states like Sudan and Ethiopia. In Melman's eyes, it is a sad truth that Israel's dealings in Africa have always been linked to arms sales, even when the countries buying weapons were engaged in bloody, sadistic civil wars. Some examples include Uganda, Congo, and Liberia. The sale of weapons to African nations has not only been vital to the Israeli economy, it has also been part of a strategy to improve Israel's intelligence on its Arab neighbors by getting a foothold in countries that border them. Ironically, one of the more troubling aspects of America's Israel policy is how Washington has turned a blind eye to Israel as it uses part of the tens of billions of dollars in U.S. aid over several decades to expand the Israeli arms industry. The result has been profit losses to American arms companies, which have had to compete with their Israeli counterparts across the globe. The arms industry overall has always been controlled by ex-politicians, ex-military, military, and retired intelligence figures who maintain a high level of cover for their business dealings. Some surveys have identified Israel as number three in the world of weapons makers. Its customers are spread across the globe and include Eastern Europe, from which it was banned during the Cold War. Since the 1980s, Israel has been selling weapons to China. The dangers of that trade can be seen in the way Israel acquired Sidewinder air-to-air missiles from the United States and then secretly used the technology to create a similar missile called the Python 3. The Chinese bought Pythons and fitted them to jet fighters built around Israeli jet designs. In 2001, Chinese jet fighters armed with Pythons were on the verge of bringing down U.S. surveillance planes. Page 17, AFP on the scene with Pat Shannon. League of the South holds annual meeting in Atlanta, by Pat Shannon. Atlanta, Georgia. At its 17th annual national conference on October 8th and 9th, League of the South conference speakers made plain again their founding goal of delegitimating the American empire. From its inception, the League of the South has stated there is no meaningful difference between mainstream conservatives and liberals or between Republicans and Democrats, and the August 28th Glenn Beck exhibition at the Lincoln Memorial, as AFP previously reported, revealed that false dichotomy, the League says. League Speaker Mike Crane pointed out that while both Beck and black activist Al Sharpton have a dream, as did their heroes Lincoln and Martin Luther King, their dreams do not match, and both are at odds with the dream of the Southern people, which is to restore the principles of the Founding Fathers. Sketching obscure history that is unknown to most Americans, Crane said the real day of infamy in America was at its founding, June 19, 1787, when the Constitutional Convention ignored the warnings of anti-federalists like Patrick Henry and delegated specific powers to the central government that would prove disastrous. Foreseeing the future better than any, Henry knew the strength of states' rights and had told the delegates that one central government, an out-of-control monster that he knew a national government would become, could not reign over such a vast land and populace without despotism. Crane told his audience that while the Constitution has failed, all attempts at reform have only sunken us deeper into despotism. Rather than reform, he said, the far more important mission is to restore. Reverend Franklin Sanders, distinguished in his clerical collar beneath a neatly trimmed beard, spoke out at the League's conference against the declining morals of Americans, saying that the tattoo mania is but another ritual display to the pagan gods. Sanders said that the South has not lost the battle but has been bought off, and clarified this with figures showing that government spending generates from 20% to as high as 60% of individual incomes in the southern states. We are the economic colony of the North, he said. Since its founding by Dr. Michael Hill in 1994, the League of the South has sought to advance the cultural, social, economic, and political well-being and independence of the Southern people by all honorable means. For cultural distinctiveness, the League eschews the use of Webster's so-called American English orthography, which, they say, actually is nothing more than a degradation of the proper and correct English language by New England busybodies. The League is also an outspoken advocate of the need for homeschooling. Its website is dixienet.org, dixienet.org. Page 19, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. Americans need to make better effort to buy American, by Jim Trafficant. Everybody talks about jobs at election time. Politicians promise jobs, the media promote jobs, chambers of commerce claim they want to attract jobs, but when all is said and done, the election concludes and it's business as usual. Yet, the business of job creation is totally screwed up. Jobs are mainly being created by the government. Most new jobs are, in fact, a part of Uncle Sam's umbrella. In other words, taxpayers are hiring workers that are basically not needed. Politicians continue to convince the masses that this hiring process is good for America, since it seemingly keeps the economy viable. The truth of the matter is that the government keeps hiring because the private sector is not. Companies are cautious. They evaluate employment needs seriously. When the private sector hires, they take on a huge expense and commitment. In addition to an average wage of $20 per hour, they also must factor in health insurance, unemployment compensation costs, workers' compensation, pension contributions, sick days, vacation, and a number of other federal, state, and local requirements. That is why the private sector is so careful about hiring. They must be able to justify each new job, or they could begin the inexorable slide toward bankruptcy. The government has no such worries. They just raise a debt limit and boast how their tough decisions have saved our economy. In all fairness, government is not the only entity in America that's to blame. How about us, a consumer? How can we be part of the blame for the lack of decent-paying jobs? Let's consider the consumption practices of John Q. Citizen of Anywhere USA. John wakes up at 6 a.m. having set his alarm clock, made in Japan, the night before, while his coffee pot made in China brews his Java. John lathers his face with gel made in Italy. He then shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. John then buttons his silk dress shirt made in Sri Lanka before cooking his breakfast in an electric skillet made in India. Breakfast is enjoyed on his new kitchen table and chairs made in Canada. He then sits at his English-made desk and turns on his calculator made in Mexico to compute his finances. He jumps in his German-made car, stops at the local mall built by a Japanese conglomerate, and buys foreign-made designer jeans and tennis shoes. He purchases a newspaper owned by a European syndicate so he can read the want ads, looking for a job. Finding nothing, he becomes frustrated and discouraged, so he heads home, where his slippers, his wine, and virtually everything else he owns is foreign-made, meaning that his own consumer dollars do not support U.S. employers who create jobs in the private sector. You see, we all play a part in this deteriorating economy. It hurts the economy every time we choose a foreign-made product over an American-made product. But America will not create private sector jobs until our government removes the costly burdens that are killing our companies and manufacturers. The income tax must be abolished, and the 16th Amendment to our Constitution to establish the income tax must be repealed, even though I believe the amendment was never legally ratified. The Internal Revenue Service also must be abolished. We need tariffs on imports, along with a flat national consumption tax, only on new goods and services. I want your feedback. Get back at me. The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. Call your congressman and say no to reinstitution of draft by Vince Ryan. When he was a senator, Barack Obama on September 7, 2008, as a guest on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, stated, "I had to sign up for the Selective Service when I graduated from high school, and I actually always thought of the military as an ennobling and, you know, honorable option. But keep in mind that I graduated in 1979. We weren't engaged in active military conflict at that point, and so it's not an option that I ever decided to pursue." Today, some Americans think that the burden or duty of defending the United States must be shared across the board, not just by those volunteers who believe that, by serving in dead-end wars, they will be rewarded with college money or skilled technological careers. Take note that on July 15, 2010, Representative Charles Rangel, Democrat, New York, introduced the Universal National Service Act, H.R. 5741, which was referred to the Armed Services Committee and its Subcommittee on Military Personnel. The bill would reinstate a compulsory draft, or alternative national service, during times of war for men and women, ages 18 to 42, who are citizens or permanent residents of the United States. Rangel has introduced this bill in 2003, 2004, 2006, and 2007. Remember, after this year's elections, a lame duck session likely will take up this matter. Let your representative and senators in Congress know you do not support this bill. For talking points, go back to March 23, 2002, when Representative Ron Paul, Republican, Texas, introduced legislation expressing the sense of Congress that the United States government should not revive military conscription. Supporters of conscription have taken advantage of the events of September 11th to renew efforts to reinstate the military draft. However, reviving the draft may actually weaken America's military. Furthermore, a military draft violates the very principles of individual liberty. It is no exaggeration to state that military conscription is better suited for a totalitarian government, such as the recently dethroned Taliban regime, than a free society. Paul added, "The basic premise underlying conscription is that the individual belongs to the state. Individual rights are granted by the state, and therefore politicians can abridge individual rights at will." In contrast, the philosophy which inspired America's founders in the Declaration of Independence is that individuals possess natural, God-given rights which cannot be abridged by government. A military draft also appears to contradict the constitutional prohibition of involuntary servitude. Daniel Webster, during the War of 1812, challenged his listeners to show, "Where is it written in the Constitution? In what article or section is it contained? That you may take children from their parents, and parents from their children, and compel them to fight the battles of war, in which the folly or the wickedness of government may engage it." Ronald Reagan, Henry David Thoreau, Barry Goldwater, Bill Bradley, Jesse Ventura, and organizations such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the United Methodist Church General Board of Church and Society, the National Taxpayers Union, and the Conservative Caucus have opposed the draft. So opposition comes from the right and the left. On February 17, 2009, Congressman Paul told the House that involuntary servitude was supposed to be abolished by the 13th Amendment, but things like the Selective Service and income tax made him wonder how serious we really are about defending basic freedoms. A military draft could demand your very life without your consent. This should be unthinkable in a free society, Paul continued. Proponents of reinstating the draft claim it is needed to protect liberty from enemies abroad. I am convinced that there are more threats to American liberty within a 10-mile radius of my office on Capitol Hill than there are in the rest of the globe. Paul adds that most in the military are against a draft. There is a vast difference between serving alongside another volunteer and serving alongside a reluctant conscript. He recognized that a flawed foreign policy prompts the need for a draft. Abolishing the Selective Service is one thing we could do to counter those efforts, he suggested.